Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. I'm sure all of our listeners are familiar with opinion polls and surveys. Politicians and corporations in particular seem to be enthusiastic about finding out what voters or consumers are thinking, or, for example, for their purposes, their own purposes. But what about a project that aims to survey the cultural values, attitudes, and beliefs of the entire human family? And what if the motivation for this project is neither political nor commercial, but purely scientific? Such a project is the World Values Survey, an ambitious effort to characterize the state of mind of the entire human race, what matters to people, why it matters, and how we humans think about the world and our place in it. Our guest today is someone who has played a pivotal role with respect to the World Values Survey in Canada. Guy Lachapelle is a professor of political science at Concordia University in Montreal, and he has been the Canadian Principal Investigator, or PI, for the World Values Survey for a number of years. He's here to tell us more about this groundbreaking assessment tool and what it tells us about ourselves. Guy, welcome to Planetary Conversation, and it is wonderful to have you join us here today.
Thank you, Warren.
Now, how many years have you actually been involved with I'll call it the WVS, the World Values Survey. How long have you been involved with it now?
Well, I've been involved on two grounds. As the principal investigator for Canada since 2018. But before that, when I was for 20 years the Secretary General of the International Political Science Association, the World Values Survey is the outgrowth of the efforts of Ronald Ingerlart, and Ronald has created this research committee within the International Political Science Association on working on the comparative perspective of how culture is changing over time. But I will say, originally, I think as Ron was a grad student in Europe in the 1960s, he was interested by the change during the upright of students in France and tried to understand those cultural change and how values are changing.
Yes.
And myself, as a doctoral student at Northwestern in Chicago, we had to study and work with the data of the European Value Survey and the World Value Survey. So my interest on culture and comparing cultures, I think, is coming from a long, long time. I am a comparativist. I always thought that it were to compare what we are with other countries, or even other regions within Canada.
Sure.
And that's really at the heart, I would say, of that big project of Ron Ingerlart and all the other researchers that joined throughout the years of this great project.
And this is a mammoth project. It's the world's largest non-commercial social survey. Why don't you lay out the scope a little bit? Because it really is quite astonishing. 150 national teams, 30,000 publications use the data. Talk about citations and downloads. There's a huge number of these going on all the time.
Well, the beauty of this project from the beginning was to make all the data accessible worldwide.
What
so many scholars, any young scholar want to work with the data, they are available. So if you go on the World Value Survey Organization website, so you can download all the information about each waves of the surveys, everything that has been done. You have articles, and also now it's a network of researchers where, as I was saying previously, is that we do meet almost on a monthly basis. So anybody can join that discussion. If somebody published a paper, so let's having him on the air and discuss that through with the new technology. This is fabulous that we can share our views and how things are changing, like on a survey, research on populism, which has been popular in recent years, the rise of populism everywhere. So we can exchange our thoughts and the reason of that and explaining why those center right wing or very far on the right movement has been drawn in different countries. And that's the beauty of that. It's open access. Everybody can look at it and write papers and do research with the data.
Isn't that a wonderful contrast to the tendency now for barricades to be put up around information? I'm thinking of Getty Images, just for example, the famous picture bank that you can't use their picture without a lawyer coming and calling you in your home and practically dragging you out of your bed screaming, saying, you copied a picture that's copyrighted. You can't do that. If you want to do it, you have to pay a lot of money or else we'll have the lawyers come and arrest you. I mean, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but there's this open access process is such a wonderful gift to humanity, if you want to call it that. It's a powerful tool. Now, this is the eighth iteration. This is number eight version of the World Value Survey. And it's quite a project each time it goes out. It takes 2 years. I think when is the report? I think it's coming out this year, is it not?
Well, between each wave, there's a five-year period.
Right.
So during this 5 years period, everybody, to be able to reach people in over 80 countries now. So the timing of the survey is in the hands of each investigator in each country. The main things and the first thing is to raise the money to do those kind of and this is one of the reasons I think we are all professor in university, so we have to apply for research grants.
Right.
So this is why in some country you might see some country that are absent, but sometimes it's because cuts in our educations on our research funding. As we see now in the United States and many sectors. So,
my goodness.
So it's part of that. So the 5 years period, I think, give a sense to each country to try to get the money, get the support, and that's why Canada, for example, since 1981, we missed twice. One of the round because of the lack of funding. Not to say that my colleague didn't make all the efforts. It's just sometimes the timing is that governments are cutting on research or the importance of these kind of research. We have to do some PR as well to explain why these studies are important, and they are important for decision makers.
Yeah,
and
for
I
sure.
Think that's what. Well, sure. That they should understand what's going on in other country and find and to always to be in a solution mode, I will say, to look over how to resolve these international problems that are pretty common in many countries. So now we are 24 to the end of 28. So for the last wave. So this is the I did I think the second one in that way for Canada.
Yes.
So I did that earlier. But the comparison still is important that over that we can compare with the same questions all over and across the world. And that's the beauty of that, sir.
The other thing that's the beauty of it is that the original purpose is still there, which is to show change. It's to show evolution of thinking and reacting around the world. The issues that the survey has looked at for a long time are things around, for example, social, political, economic conditions, gender, family, religion, poverty, education, health, security. These are all issues that affect everybody around the world. And now, as you just mentioned earlier, there's an interest in some newer issues that are really affecting people's lives, things like political trust, things like authoritarianism and populism. I always think populism is a funny name because it's usually run by autocrats who aren't at all interested in the people. Things like immigration, climate, family planning, these are all things that clearly each generation, each decade brings forward. And you also mentioned when we spoke earlier that there's a growing trend towards involving non-governmental organizations and the what we could broadly call the development community. That's having an influence now, is it?
Well, absolutely. I think that's in many countries, I think the power is not anymore at the center. I think people, the trust in government has been in decline in many countries. Mm-hmm. And it has been translated also by the fact that sometimes politicians don't understand what's going on in their own country or regionally. And it goes on both ways. So yes. It's part of what we are trying to measure. The trust in government, yes, it's important. And this is why people try to be, some people were saying, yeah, you have to be the famous phrase, you have to think globally, but you're acting locally. and that's what matters. And locally, mm-hmm. I think that's what we see those efforts made by citizens to try to be involved in their community, to yes. be involved in resolving their problems, but sharing also with other other citizens in other part of the country or mm-hmm. in the world.
Yeah.
Many of the problems we see today are happening everywhere now. When there's a shooting, as we saw in Canada, we saw that, and we are not exempt of that. I think that the world and through the media now, I think people can see what's going on elsewhere.
Yes,
so
that's right.
The rise of violence, for example, I think, or the way the attitude of teenagers and others, that's part of our interest also, and the family ties also is a. Was it's not new. We talk about family ties, but it's different now. People are spread. They work in different part of their own country or in the world. So this is the globalization effect. I try to summarize in one word, but that's what we are looking now. From I would say maybe national agenda. Now the agenda is more international, and everybody has to be involved in looking at that. And I think for the new generation, one topic which really matters is climate change. I think everybody are concerned and about their climate change and security goes together, I would say, in many countries.
And that's
what we saw in the news each day. So we have to tackle these problems.
And what you said earlier about politicians not always knowing about the issues that they're actually facing within their own population is an interesting point. And I think it's borne out by a lot of decision-making that takes place at the higher political level. People just don't seem to be in touch with what's going on in communities. Now, some of the trends that we talked about when we spoke earlier, that the survey, the World Value Survey, has brought forward are, for example, there's an increase in equality between men and women. There's a trend towards more balanced relationships between men and women. Do you want to just, I'll just mention a couple of these and you can just maybe add a couple of words about them. So what about that? What about that trend? What are the nuts and bolts of that trend?
Well, clearly back in the 60s when the role of the state has increased everywhere, the responsibility and the implementation of health policy, social policy, and family policy as well in recent years with kindergartens and support for families. I think that's, and we see politicians these days talking still about that, to reconcile working and having families and everything. It's a topic that concerns a lot of younger people. And since the 60s, the difference is that women now are more active on the work market. They are everywhere. They do play an important role. Before they were kept in, but they still, I think we've seen that their interest over social welfare policy programs is much higher usually than men. So it's, because they have to face, they have to go with kids sometime. There's the traditional family that also is expanding now, but I would say the fundamentals are there. I think the security of the families is important. I think people are and offering better educations, better social services, helping the growth, as we have seen in many Nordic countries, for example, is more the equality and the, I would say, the social democratic place in the world are have a tendency to be more active on these question of over equality.
That's right. Social democracy
and social democracy and equality is one of the key elements, I think. That really changed. I always said that the most important revolution we saw on that ground was the contraceptive pills in the 1960s.
Absolutely.
It makes things completely different. I think we forgot about these innovative things that happen in our society. Innovation is at the heart of that as well. So sometimes we should forget about politics. Sometimes it's just groundbreaking at the normal life of people in general. And this is what matters. Just to come back on politicians, I think politicians have in many countries this difficulty to understand the change. And since they are, they don't want necessarily also to change their own institution to respond to the needs of people.
Yes.
And this is where we are. I think we have to sometimes to redraft in many countries their structures, the way to give a voice to citizens, and that citizens should have a better voice and be represented by the government.
On that note, we talked a little bit when we spoke earlier about the movement towards proportional representation, which is talking about changing institutions. Changing the electoral system is a powerful way to change public participation in government activities. That trend, is that showing up, or some awareness of it showing up in what the World Value Survey comes up with? And in addition, because you are political sciences study politics, obviously, are you seeing a trend in that direction, both in this country but around the world as well, because of your involvement with international political science?
Absolutely. I think I saw, again, to give a better voice. The question is more: is the proportional system better than the our first past the post system? And I think that's the kind of questions people have. There are still debates within the community of political scientists, even within Canada. Some people are opposed to it still. They still prefer the whole British parliamentary system because it gives clear majority. This is the kind of things we heard all the time. But it might give that, but this is for politicians. The question of the regions also has grown over. Many regions are very active, very... And I'm talking not just provinces in terms of in Europe, the region, in the European community, the regions have seats. So there's a meaning of regions. Some regions are very, very much economically. They take over. They are very innovative. They try to improve the well-being of their citizens, of course. Right. But they are looking at that. So how politics and the parliamentary the electoral system is one of them. So the question is how and what's really doesn't help democracy in its corruptions, and corruptions are linked. So people who are working and say, how can we have a politician who can respond to these problems and that and face the needs and the requests of citizens so that's a difficult task. There's no perfect political system. We know that. So I'm not sure some people would like the American political system. Some days it works. It is the oldest democracy. So we have to evolve and try to find how democracy can be improved. I think that's the bottom line of the discussion. Yes, to answer clearly your question, yes, there's an increase of interest on changing the electoral system, getting rid of old institutions and bring a better governance. I think that's the bottom line.
Now, a parallel process there, which is also emerging from the data of the World Value Survey, is an increased reliance on local government. turning to the, as you mentioned earlier, you want to see the face of the person and be able to speak to the person who's making decisions about your community. And local government is obviously a process, a setting in which that can take place. And that is turning up in the data, I believe.
There are some countries who are very decentralized, I would say, in terms of fiscal policy, for example. And again, I'm thinking of the Nordic countries.
Indeed.
You cannot just look at the national data on health expenditures, because the health expenditures are, it's a local matters, and the money have been transferred to the regions in those countries. That's a former colleague who was minister in Sweden who told me that, look, forget about our national data. and it's a bit the same thing in Canada, because healthcare, as we know, it's a provincial jurisdiction, yes. Constitutionally, with the social welfare. So we have a kind of, as many political scientists are saying, a kind of a hybrid system. Yes. So in a hybrid system like that, you have to manage at both the federal and the provincial level.
Yes,
so
indeed.
These kind of models are improving. There's throughout our survey for greater decentralization of power.
Yes.
And they do ask for that everywhere. And in some country, as we know, citizens feel that politicians are pretty much, again, remote, and there's no way they can enter in that kind of elitist model of governance.
That's right.
It remains the chasse-garde of some politicians, and they don't like to see other people of other natures coming in. So that's part of the, yes, your question is clear. There's been a bring more accountability.
Sure.
Within the, each political system.
Now, a parallel process, which is a form you might call an oblique form of decentralization, is a decline in the United States, which was well known for the adherence to religion and formal religion. And that's declining. And in parallel with that is a decline in intolerance towards people of different sexual orientations, LGBTQ community. You wouldn't know it from the current noise that's being made south of the border, but there is a overall trend, and this is where the survey is useful. It's showing this increased tolerance, while the public media are all preoccupied with the negative, you know, the great criticisms of people of different sexual orientations. Maybe you could talk about that, because the government seems to be detached, if you like, from what the people are actually doing in their own communities.
Yeah, minorities in general, I think I've been much more involved in politics than before.
Yes.
And I'm saying sexual minorities or even other
racial,
all the rise of social movement, the racial movement in the United States,
right,
or in Canada. All of this is, I think people, and it goes with the question of equality also, that you should have the same rights than everybody. So this is where we are. We are in a situation now. And this is what the World Value Survey has monitored over time, asking the same question over years.
Yes.
We noticed that in the last two or three waves of the World Value Survey, that there is a greater tolerance, acceptance of difference of people who are different, with different values, different sexual orientations.
Right.
The difficulty is to reconcile all this. And it's this is where there's a back and forth in many countries, because it's a... depending with some power and so on. So people have politicized that as well.
Yeah.
So that's a good example of where the groups, the core people who have the same attitude or values seems to work together more. And it's true for, I'm thinking even in Canada, the native people are talking now about having their own political parties. When
yes.
I heard that, I said, oh, so here we have a sectoral politics in a way. So we are going back to some people who having their own finding the traditional way politics work. They need another model that in which they can be included. So this is why we're talking a lot about inclusion these days. We noticed that 20 years ago, and Engelhard has this great idea about moving to a circular society, and how from one generation to the next, people are their values are changing, and And we're moving to what he called, in our language, post-materialist values, which is more questions of community, environment, mm-hmm. versus the old conservative, what he called materialist values, just thinking about money and your personal well-being. We are all societies all on that spectrum of that a bit. Everybody, there's no totally post-materialist society, and there's no totally materialist society of values. I think people evolve in that. So you can find a good share of people sharing more post-materialists, or for politicians, this is why we have different parties with different ideas. we try to attract a specific kind of, I will call, spectator of politics, and you want to get them. So yes, there's greater tolerance in general, I will say, because on other topic like immigrations, we see a lot of tension. This is one of the issue that worldwide, I think, and it's just because there's greater insecurity in the world.
Yes,
people are leaving their country. They come. They want to find a safe place for their family, to have a better education, and this movement of population is growing also in the last 20 years. So when we do a survey in the country, the place of refugees versus immigrants or other type of citizens also play a role. So in recent years, we heard a lot about immigrations and how our society can better, or community better, integrate these people in a respectful way. And there's a great story, and there's also other place where it's much more difficult.
One of the things that listeners would probably be interested in is to hear some of the actual questions. And I didn't. It's a long survey with a lot of questions. but there are some that I think speak to what we're just talking about. For example, this question number 200. When you get together with your friends, would you say you discuss political matters frequently, occasionally, or never? I mean, that's a basic question about what do you say about your community? What do you say about your country? They say, you know, you should never talk about politics, religion, or sex at your supper table, but obviously people do. And so that's an interesting question. Why don't you say a couple of words about that?
I think you focus on a very interesting question and debate about the place of politics in general in the personal life. Even a political scientist don't ask the question. A political scientist, we think that everybody talk politics, but in fact, it's less than 1% of people, I would say, who are really interested by politics in general. So the fraternity is pretty small, I would say, in general. But most people don't necessarily like politics and think that's to discuss that. In Quebec, we used to say that's this is all topics for Christmas time discussions around La Tourtière and whatever. So people in general, and it's true everywhere, I think that politics matters when there's elections. And when there's election, you have your choice, your people. So that's where it's important. The question of how politicized you are, that's the idea of, behind that. And your knowledge of politics, your capacity to judge the policies or to bring ideas in that's part of the discussion. The other things is many people did not necessarily have a political opinion, but they have the opinion shared by their friends and so on. The concept beyond that, there's colleagues who call about wrote books on the what we call the silent majority. There's an important silent majority in all societies. Mm-hmm. People who have opinion, but they don't feel at ease when we talk politics. And how can you hear these people at least participating in the politics or having some interest on the issue that matters to them? So this is a kind of question testing how far people are ready to go in politics. It's a question or to be engaged in discussion right. about politics. And the silent, the people remain silent. There's a lot of don't know still, of people who have no ideas about politics.
One question I thought must have really struck a different kind of chord was a question that's very practical and very down to earth, but also must seem a bit esoteric to some people. And that is this question, number 92. Where are the headquarters of the International Monetary Fund located? And I was thinking of somebody in a Southeast Asian village who might be answering this question would say, I haven't a clue. I mean, you can't say, I haven't a clue, although it does say, I don't know, is one of the answers you can give. What a question like that seems to me very, it would require political knowledge and political acumen and somebody who studies the structure of political system. A question like that, would that be one that shows a divide between one part of the world and another, or between, it must be tied to education, to age, to, you know, all sorts of parameters that would limit it in some ways and broaden it in other ways?
Yes, but it's a question of knowledge. There's other organizations also that are mentioned. I guess the people know where are the United Nations, maybe not the International Monetary Funds or other organizations. So it's a way to measure knowledge of politics, to grade that in a way. Your point about the perspective in different part of the world, yes, because we might take for granted the International Monetary Fund but the question is, for in some countries they are pretty dependent financially of those organizations as well. So this is the goal of trying to see the differences. But I will say, yes, it goes with education. So it's a question of people interesting more about economics, I would say, than others. So it gave us a kind of a perspective on the number of organizations which matter, right, and then people who have in some of those organizations. So it's a very common, question that you find even in Canadian politics in general.
Now, one question I think would have universal resonance, and that is question number 51 to 55, because there's multiple answers. In the last 12 months, how often have you or your family gone without enough food to eat, felt unsafe from crime in your home, gone without medicine or medical treatment that you needed, gone without a cash income, and gone without a safe shelter over your head? In this part of the world, questions like that don't come up all that often, but there are many parts of the world where these are absolutely salient issues in people's lives. Why don't you talk about that kind of disparity around the world?
Well, inequalities is over everywhere, even in Canada. I will say it varies from regions, from communities. And this question, I think, is important because it's a question of security, how secure you are, and the capacity of institution to deliver, to give you support in a way in improving your well-being. Inequality is at the heart of many things, even politics. That shapes the security. And Engelhardt model at the beginning with other colleagues were looking at that specific, as many sociologists did, how those inequalities, social inequality or economic inequalities are really shaping and have a great influence on your confidence in the futures for your families. And confidence in our system, it's clearly the question is the system fair for everybody or not? And even in the United States, we saw that what we observe as a social change is those what we call the working pool, poor, mm-hmm. where people are working and they don't have enough money to pay for all of their families' needs. So that's a phenomenon that affected more the industrial countries, but it's, we'll say, since the 70s and 60s, when there's an economic crisis, this is what happened. And sometimes in some countries, because unemployment is too high, there's not enough investment in some sectors, or the poverty level is high. So both are going together. I would say inequalities goes with poverty, and we have poverty in Canada as well. So
we
it's
do.
Just
we, do.
We have to face this problem, and that and first having a good assessment of who are these poor people. And this is what we found also, because our survey also we compare between age group. So that's important values, or between men and women, or regions. So we know that there's these kind of change. Not everybody has a very good security system. Not everybody has a good pension system when they retire. So we see that clash, I would say, between people who are older versus the younger people. And is in the recent year, we noticed a greater insecurity among young people.
Oh, for sure.
The economy, that things are increasing, cost of living is increasing, housing is increasing. So all of this make people pretty insecure about their futures. And we see that even in Canada. It hurt my heart all the time when I see a family unable to put something on the table for their children.
Yeah.
It's not acceptable for Canada, but in other countries, we might say, well, it's more difficult to resolve these problems. So this is part of we are not involved in saying to politicians what to do, but at least to understand the problem and understand through the survey that the question is that now who are the people who are the most affected by that, and how we can reach them and bring or collaborate between countries or organization to improve their improve to resolve that for a good time at least.
The ability for anybody, because we talked earlier about the open access of the data that come from the World Value Survey, the ability of individuals anywhere to have a snapshot or a broad picture of what's going on in the world around them, as opposed to what's going on in their neighborhood or their immediate community, is, it seems to me, in and of itself a powerful tool that just changes everything. It's like what was said about the first images of the Earth taken from the, you know, space ventures. It changed everything. We realized that we're a little blob in a big dark space. This question I'd like to throw out now is one about what we've talked about earlier. You mentioned earlier about trust and trust in politicians, but this is a question that deals with trust at multiple levels. It's five or six different questions, and the respondent is asked to say, do they trust completely, somewhat, not trust very much, or do not trust at all? The following six different categories of settings. Do you trust your family? Do you trust your neighborhood? Do you trust people you know personally? Do you trust people you meet for the first time? Do you trust people of another religion? Or do you trust people of another nationality? Now, to me, that seems like a question that is getting to the heart of many day-to-day encounters between citizens in different parts of the world, or people in the social media, people traveling to other parts of the world from their home location. This question really is the kind of question that must give really important information to the scholars, the political players, the citizens in community organizations who want to know what's going on. The kind of answers that people give to this particular set of questions must be very illuminating for a lot of people.
Absolutely. I think that's, I will give you two examples. I saw recently there was a poll done by the Pew Research Center in US, which I did in Canada and it was a question of trust in the American president, simply. And the trust, I give you as this example because it's really in our daily spotlight in Canada, but it's just the trust of that. The two countries first to have less trust in the Trump administration is Mexico and Canada, in the worldwide. People who are remote from the U.S. or not been engaged in a free trade agreement and so on, have different views as well. There are some people, of course, the Israeli have a greater trust in the Trump administration, but it's because of their internal questions and politics. So yes, trust is for different. And in Canada, to my surprise, 85% of Quebecers don't trust the public administration. This is the highest score in Canada. So and the lowest is in Alberta at 65. But still, nobody trusts. Nobody trusts. But there's differences.
Yeah.
So how can we explain that? So between the tie between and I'm coming back to these questions about family, people you know, cultural convergence on some issues and other. All this is part of that idea. The other things we saw in Minneapolis, what happened there with ICE and so in the United States, these questions of trust were important because that's we saw that the community there say, we don't trust these guys. We don't trust the police officer. We don't trust the army to secure our environment. So take these examples and put that in a worldwide situation in different countries. If you are in a country which has an authoritarian government, do you trust your army? Do you trust the people who have the power in a way to seize your goods or house? And so that's against in the World Value Survey from the beginning, the question of security, the questions of equality in a different way and democracy, all of these goes together. And we have to monitor that. We have to monitor that if people cannot go, we take that for granted in Canada, and that's where we wake up, we go to work and so on. But for some people, it's very difficult because they don't know if what's going to happen, for whatever reason, just walking from their own to their workplace. So this is what it's all about. Family is important. Friends is important. If you're in an environment, that's interesting because I have some colleagues from all over the world who were asking them, how many friends do you have? Who are your friends? Who they are? And some colleagues in Russia were saying, well, I don't have friends and I don't trust any of the other people around me because I don't know who is going to have an influence who they talk for or do they talk just to get some information?
Yes.
Well, that's a problem with intellectual in general. People don't trust them in the world, especially politicians. So that's what we're measuring anyhow. But it's an important sentiment, and the cultural map is based on that. If you go on the World Value Survey organization, you see the evolution of the map, and recently what have been added, and I think I really wanted to add that is that. The Muslim countries now. We had a number of Muslim countries. And that's one of the efforts of the World Value Survey Organization to know what's going on in the Middle East and with the Arab worlds and so on. And that will also bring more elements for comparison and seeing how more, I would say, not religious, but in terms of religiosity or values, how did that play in their in the local environment? And then when we talk about the equality of men and women, as we talked earlier, there is differences clearly
for sure
in those countries. We know that, and we noticed and we saw that.
And the interesting thing, of course, is they will notice that there are countries that are not like theirs too. They would see what's going on in other countries, and ordinary citizens can do that now. I'm sure listeners by now are aware from the complete answers you've given to me that you are a very knowledgeable political scientist and well-informed person. And I had written in my notes that I was going to say, this is not your first rodeo, but I thought that was a little bit overly colloquial. But you have been doing political science for a very long time. Listeners should know, you have a very distinguished career in political science. You trained at the University of Montreal. And at Northwestern University in the United States. And over the years, you've had positions of leadership within the political science world that are really quite important. Head of the Quebec Political Science Association, and you mentioned earlier for years, decades, the International Political Science Association, 2000 to 2020, organized world congresses of political scientists globally, And not surprising, you now at Concordia University, you're the director of the Center on Values, Attitudes, and Societies. It seems to me that's very closely linked to your involvement with the World Value Survey. But when I asked you, you said spontaneously, you said, "Well, but I'm a North American," and you made reference to roots. One was intriguing to me was Ireland, a connection to Ireland, and then of course Quebec and the United States, because you had worked and studied in. But tell listeners a little about your Irish connection, because there's something unique about Ireland. It figures in a lot of cultures around the world.
Yeah, but it's not common in Quebec, as you know. The Irish community has been involved. My grandmother was a Mary Boyce coming from Ireland in the 19th century. But she married La Chapelle. That's what it about it. But the Irish community has always been involved. And Montreal has the oldest Irish parade, I think, in North America. Mm. So that link is still interesting. Anyhow, I think that's part of our culture. I think that's in Canada and United States. Well, having family members who left Quebec back in the 1930s, simply because as Canada was essentially a farming country, and many people were finding lands free in the United States and a good education system as well. Sure. So people were leaving the border. American thinks there's a border. Canadians don't think there's a border. So we weren't crossing the border easily. As my grandfather said, there's no problem. There's a border, but you will not see it when you will walk through the other
side. It's not invisible.
So this is part of our, each person has his own story. Mm-hmm. Now we see more Franco-American coming back to Quebec, which I'm not surprised. They don't speak French necessarily, but it's, I have a cousin who has the same age as me. We live in Bedford near Boston, and we talk. He's a big fan of the Canadian, the hockey player. So he wants just to talk to me about hockey more than, but how tough it is even in Boston, the Boston area. But anyhow, we have to know that as well. But personally, I think I would say, you mentioned what I did at IPSA. For me, the most important thing is to maintain a dialogue. Dialogue between cultures, a dialogue between citizens. If we don't, we have nowhere to do that, that will have an effect on our future and democracy, I think. And that was the heart of when the International Political Science Association was created in 1949 after the war. That was the goal of creating the Sociological Association, psychology, and others. So the people in the United Nations, that was what they wanted. They say we should not have no war and we have to get engaged in dialogue.
Yes.
And create the institution that permit that as well.
Right.
So I'm always, even when in Canada sometime, I say, well, why we don't know what's going on in other regions and so on, and how people think about it. So it's true everywhere. Let's have no prejudice and just try to get the straight fact and get engaged in a better exchange, as we do now today.
We do indeed. Guy, what got you, as a young fellow, what got you interested in studying political science broadly? I mean, did you little sessions with your family say, I'm going to give a speech now about politics? Or was it more organic, your movement into the field?
I would say that which probably drives me is probably because I have a family were abroad. Hmm. First of all, I have a aunt who, as a priest, worked in Africa for 20 years. So we were receiving a little gift all the time on Christmas from Africa. So it's opened my eyes that other things in the world. I would say the importance of education. I think most people will tell you that probably how education is important. African colleagues are saying the same thing, how you have to educate people first and education. And in these days, I'm a bit puzzled by seeing that all governments are cutting on higher educations, and we have to bring people from other countries as well to learn what they are doing. So that's for education. I think that's my mother's side. Mm-hmm. Education was very, very important. On my father's side, was more interested about innovation, the development of new tools and so on. So that's the other side of my interest, how to innovate and so on. So you know, personality is a sum of different influence we have over time. And I would say what's jumped me in interesting by politics in the early 70s is essentially because we need to change the society. Well, I'm not going to give you a full history of Quebec, but it's certainly a period where there was there was class struggle between the British who were in Montreal versus yes. the Francophone were poor. We saw that, we lived that. So, but why there's so much discrepancy? And the fact was education. And I am the first generation of people who went to university in the 1960s. That was common in Montreal. That was common everywhere in the world. So, so through education, you can go. And I always admire research in the United States. I always thought that there was good university. I was reading that. Compared to other places in the world, I thought the U.S. and I said, well, we're lucky if they're just our neighbors. So, and there's top university there. And Northwestern, by the way, the reason I went there is that it's a quantitative university. We are doing surveys, and when you were doing computers or stats or whatever, there was always on the top of the listing that we were seeing at the time when they were coming out, a Vogelbach Computing Center, Northwestern University. Hmm. So at the University of Montreal, I saw that. I saw Northwestern. I said, well, yeah,
I'm going there.
But just the last word I was saying, we need great leaders. And we had a great opportunity in Quebec of having René Lévesque as leader. Oh, René yes. Lévesque was a tremendous. Still today, when we do polls on leadership in Canada, he's coming on the top. Mr. Lévesque, because he served in the U.S. Army, because he was a journalist and at CBC doing international affairs.
Point de mire.
I think everybody had an interest as a great journalist. And then he went to politics, not because he loved politics, because he said, well, that's the way I can change things. And and that's why he had the respect. I would say, well, I know he had a good relationship with Peter Lougheed, for example, in Alberta for at the time in the 1970s. So he was an international figure.
He was.
Who showed that he was. And the last word probably is the international exhibit in Montreal, 1967. Where we saw the world in Montreal in one. So I spent my summer traveling across the world just at 10 minutes from home. So so that was also for me. I said, why these countries exist and why they do that? So I guess this is my curiosity of the world and seeing what's going on elsewhere.
Well, your curiosity is paying dividends for lots of other people as well. We are coming to the end of the show, but I just wanted to ask you a question because you raised it in our conversation before, and that's the issue of global anxiety, the issue of a kind of upwelling, if you like, of anxiety around the world. Why don't you talk about that and talk about where we're going to go and where we have to go to address global anxiety?
I did a piece about 10 years ago, and based on the World Value Survey and other data that I had, and I did that was the title of one of the articles I wrote in the journal. And people said, I said, well, we are facing a difficult moment, first because of wars, and wars created a movement of population everywhere in Europe. The people were coming from Northern Africa. After the Gulf War and everything, they were all moving in Europe. So Europe were the first really to face that the difficulty of those changes. And for people, for governments, they were concerned, but more than concerned was they were really on the edge of it. They knew something was going to happen, and they and things were going too fast, and they didn't have the capacity to resolve and respond to these questions. So that was the first thing I would say at the organizational level to see at the personal level, the economic change. I think that's really the question of inequalities. I think for me really raised that question, and the insecurity. We have the COVID, should not forget about that. The COVID as a major health crisis. The last one was in the 1918, 1920. Mm-hmm. So we saw the epidemiologists will tell you how these also affect. There was great anxiety also during the Second World War in Canada and elsewhere, but now the things are changing. And now the fact that many countries have the nuclear powers, that's also concerning people. And plus the environmental questions of the climate change. I think there's a number of ingredients now that make people more anxious. Not to say also that people are blaming quite often the internet that give more a view of those bad news everywhere that they're going, and people don't know how to explain and to manage. So this uncertainty raised this kind of anxiety of people, and they don't have answer to all the questions. So when you don't have answer, people can behave differently, and I would say that's raised their anxiety. What's concerned me is more the young people in school. Mm-hmm. We saw in university, as I mentioned to you before, and we saw their well-being, get a good jobs. And for a generation, it was that was possible, but the having more opportunity in your life, and if you have less opportunity, of course, it raises also your personal anxiety with other people.
Guy, all I can say is our listeners must be clearly aware of the fact that you have a fount of knowledge stored away in your thoughts, in your mind, but also you're acting as kind of a force for good in the world, a force for good in the sense of information that is well-grounded, widely absorbed from different parts of the world, different kinds of people. As I said at the beginning, looking at the consciousness of the entire human race is a really important thing to do, because it automatically brings people together. People read and understand what's going on in other people's minds. I want to thank you very much for being with us today, because I think you've given a perspective that is essential for all of us to gain an understanding of people in other parts of the world and their lives. And this point you made of dialogue, the dialogue that will get us past the violence and the mistrust and the confusion and into a better place. And we need that. We absolutely need that. And I agree with you 100%. Thanks very much for being with us today. It's been a delight. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Warren. All the best.